girl.
Hello, Wade.
Love you, man. Love you,
Basically,
too.
I want you to speak up back there.
Oh, I'm loud. I'm real loud. Usually, speaking up isn't what people are asking me to do, but I'm glad you did. I'm a recovered alcoholic named Reed Martin. And I forget things, too. I was just kidding there, Curly. It actually made me feel a little bit better. I always take my big book whenever I go anywhere for a couple reasons. One is because I forget things, and I'll say them wrong and get things kind of sideways. And I don't want to screw up this message that gave me this life I have. And I want to stick to... Oh, wow, you made it.
It's good to see you.
My wife's here. That's the pretty girl over there. She worked all day and then made it over here. That's awesome. I don't want to mess up the message. And let's see, what do we got left? It's almost time to hand out the chips. And no, it's a real honor to for a couple of reasons, but to come to a a gathering that's a celebration like you guys are having, all that great food and all the people who worked to put it together and put together the group and hear about the history of how it started, people wanted to get sober, and look at how it's grown. Move from what, a garage to here, and here looks like y'all going to be moving again, because it's going to keep on growing. And I've seen that happen, and that usually happens when there's a meeting that sticks and adheres to the original program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's the written down version. We have a little bit of limited time, so sometimes, and what I've done for years is what everybody does. I for years kind of misinterpreted the program because I got confused. Because of what I read in my big book home group and then what I heard people say at meetings. And I got misled into doing what other people were doing. I just sort of, kind of heard something and then regurgitated it. And then once a week I'd go to my big book study and I'd read. And as years went by, I started to notice that what I was reading sometimes matched and sometimes didn't match what I was hearing at meetings. And one of the things that didn't match was this, tell you in a general way what I was like and what happened and what I'm like now. When I read the book in the group and the group talked about it, they made it real clear that that's a description in a book that kind of gives us a heads up on some personal stories coming down the road. And that wasn't necessarily, didn't really have that much to do with anything that was audio, the talk of some sort. Instead, after going through the big book, I moved on to some other books. There's another great book called AA Comes of Age that clarifies in great detail some short pieces out of the big book. And there's one page in there where Bill Wilson makes this statement. It was about 55 years ago, out in wherever it was, at the first international conference of Alcoholics Anonymous. He got up in front of all these people, assembled, who knows how many thousands were there. Is that good-looking fellow there on the right in the picture? And he got up in front of everybody, and I could only imagine that they were all excited that they were going to hear something fresh and hear his war stories about his brokerage days and things like that. And instead, he said this. He said, "In Alcoholics Anonymous, it is traditional that we do not make speeches. We simply talk about our own experiences and, look out, about the experiences of those around us." And I know some of y'all. And then he closed by saying, "My talk will be no different." And I've been asking my higher power all day to help me adhere to that too. That thing with the personal stories, and because I have a bad memory, I kind of have to remember what page numbers things are on. I remember some of them, but not all of them. It tells us on this one page that there's these 42 personal stories coming, or 43, depending on which edition you have, and it says that their hope that in revealing themselves in there, that no one will take that in bad taste, but they believe that by only by revealing their innermost selves and their problems, Can the alcoholic man or reader read through those pages and say, yes, I must have this thing. Yes, I'm one of these people. I must have this thing too. In other words, conclude, draw the conclusion, wow, I'm an alcoholic. And I've been here for a little while y'all are eating, and I looked around, and I don't think there's anybody in the wrong room. I think y'all all know you're here for that this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Anybody who's looking for the Rotary Club, it's down the hall. Rather than wasting time with the plane crash where my dad died and the cancer that killed my mom and my sister getting kidnapped from her home in a nice neighborhood in Greensboro and murdered and all of those other things that I endured, which were all miserable and horrible, and yes, I talk about them a lot, but not necessarily up here, because up here I've got a job to do, and that's to try to tell anybody who came, you know, carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. The alcoholic who still suffers, folks, is not always the alcoholic who's still drinking. I meet a lot of alcoholics who aren't drinking anymore, hadn't drank for a long time, and they are suffering. They're miserable. Y'all have met them, too. They're usually not very nice. There's clear-cut directions in this book on how to get that. Page 29, it lays that out for us, and I'm going to flip pages and read stuff, because if I try to quote too much, I'll screw it up. I'll leave a word out. And besides, I love a big book meeting, because then we can do this stuff. But page 29, clear-cut directions are given showing how we recovered. Oh, wait, that's something else. I'm going to need some volunteers. I need two volunteers. You... We're in my class at Freehab, so you're named one. Somebody else want to help out? That young lady, what's your name? No, you just stay right there.
Okay, good.
What's your name?
Charlene.
Charlene's going to help. Tell us. And Alan. Alan's going to help. Okay. Right there where it says, further on, clear-cut directions are given showing how we recovered. Alan, who's the we?
First 100 people.
He says the first 100 men and women who wrote this book. Is it us in this room? No. No. The book's written in first person plural. They wrote we. Let's go there. It's in the foreword of the first edition. It's the very first page ever printed of the book. It says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. So they wrote the book to us. And that's where I got confused early on. And that's where I see a lot of people get confused early on. You may not believe me, but I'm nervous as hell up here. I can't stand this. I hate this. I swear. I mean, I know it looks like, you know, and other people say it all the time, especially my family members, you know, it's whether it's a bottle or a bong or a microphone. I never met one I didn't like. And once I picked it up, I couldn't put it down. But this is so much easier to do. This is so much easier to do at some of the places I go to. My favorite place to go, you might have heard me call out Alan on it, is Freehab. I don't know that it'd be appropriate. We have a cheering section for Freehab back there. You know, it's the place where you go where you don't even have a bag of clothes left, and you can get in the door. I go there. And then there's another thing over called Guilford County Mental Health, where I was once locked in this big dog kennel they got in there. It's a cage for crazy people. And they have an intensive outpatient class, and I get invited over there to do some stuff too. And those people, believe it or not, are so open-minded, unlike the people I meet at meetings. Those people already think AA ain't going to work. They already think I've tried it and it didn't work. And it's, you know, I'm only telling you my experience of what I have gone through doing, you know, as I read the book, and it said that these two guys pictured over here on the wall, that once they figured out what they had to do, that in order to stay alive, they had to go find somebody to help. It didn't say they went to a meeting. It said they had to go find somebody to help. It said they called up their local hospital. People say it's not 1939 anymore. You can't call up the local hospital. Well, I agree. That's a valid point. Google is a much more effective way. You can get a whole list of them. And, you know, in the book it says they'll be only too glad to assist you because they're pulling their hair out. They don't know what to tell these people because they're all saying, I tried AA, I tried one of the other A's, NA or something else, and it didn't work. And so in going there, I found out that what they were talking about, the it that they were talking about and the it that I was reading about were not the same it. There were pieces and parts that were similar, but some parts were just way off base, way off base. You know, after a while, I realized that there's like three different Alcoholics Anonymouses. There's this one that those people over at the detox have been bouncing in and out of for years that they say don't work. That's these meetings and groups are all over the world where they can call themselves a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. They right away, they get a service number, and they are, that's AA. People say, go to AA. Judge says, you need to go to AA. So they go to AA. They don't know any different. They walk in the door, says AA on the door. People are doing AA stuff. They think, this is AA. And the whole time, at some meeting, somebody's talking about their lawnmower that won't start, and the neighbor that keeps, you know, the barking dog, and some other things, and they're sweating, and shaking and trying to figure out how in the hell am I going to survive this thing? This is horrible. And they leave with nothing. That doesn't happen at all meetings. At a lot of meetings, we hear all these little phrases that have been added. And these things help me a whole lot. The one I remember the most at my first, one of my first meetings, the first week, this guy said this thing that just blew me away. And this may seem so simple, but he said, and he was joking to a certain degree, he said, it's been scientifically proven that if I didn't pick up the drink or the drug, I couldn't put it in my body. Don't pick it up. That helped me a whole lot. And then the other one was, he said, if I didn't visit the people, places, and playgrounds where I used to get that stuff or where they were doing that stuff, I wouldn't be near it to pick it up. That may seem so plain, but it helped me so much. They told me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and I did. And there, at any of those meetings, no matter what they were talking about, because I wasn't paying attention most of the time, I was shaking and sweating and running back and forth outside smoking cigarettes, it didn't matter. Because I was immediately enamored with these folks. I immediately felt comfortable within just a few words or minutes of talking to anybody in there, that they understood me. That we were of like mind, that we were. I was more comfortable right away talking with those people than I was with my own family members at Christmas. And when my first Christmas came along, I had heard that there were these marathon meetings around the clock every hour on the hour, and I thought that was real nice for you folks because you might have been shaky, but I wouldn't need them. But Christmas Eve, something happened. I don't remember what it was, but I remember I drove like a bat out of hell straight to one of them clubs. And sat in that thing till 4 in the morning. And at 2 in the morning, you know, I got there, I don't know what time it was. I got there and I didn't tell anybody that I was okay. I said I was fine. And I kind of hoped that somebody would notice that I was moping and would say, you know, how are you doing? And then I could say, well, I'm you know, whatever. I didn't do that. Nobody asked. And anyway, I sat through a couple of meetings and I finally spoke up at the midnight meeting and then I felt a little better, and then there was nobody to chair the 2 a.m. meeting. There was nobody listed there, so I figured, well, I'll stay, and then everybody left. And I was in this club in the middle of this neighborhood by myself, Christmas Eve, 2 o'clock in the morning, and in comes my first sponsor and my present-day sponsor. They come walking in. And I said, what are y'all doing here? They said, we're here to chair the meeting. We do it every year on Christmas Eve. We've been doing it for 10 years. And I'm like, your name's not on the schedule. He's like, did I just tell you we've been doing it every year for 10 years? Everybody knows. You weren't here. Just because you weren't here doesn't mean we ain't been doing it for 10 years. Sit down, he said. And they were neat. They were an incredible crew. These two biker guys. And somebody already told you I used to have hair down in my elbow. I've done that twice in recovery. And then every once in a while I try and go get a job and have to cut it off. But anyway, I got to sit there in that meeting, and that first sponsor I had, and some of y'all might have remembered him. His name was Little John, and at my first meeting, Little John, or my first week, I'd been going to meetings for about a week. How am I doing? And you know, I'd picked up some stuff. I'd picked up some bits and pieces. I'd picked up the keep coming back thing. You know, I'd picked up the no matter what, don't drink, don't use, no matter what. You know, call people. Some fool wrote on this list, call any time. I called this guy at like 3 o'clock in the morning when this person living in my house was having a dope man drop off some stuff and said, I don't know what to do. And this fellow stayed on the phone with me till early in the next morning and got me to an 8 o'clock meeting, stayed on the phone with me the whole time. And so I went to meetings for a week, and that held me. Now, the part I'm talking about here is the fellowship. Remember I said there's several AAs. There's this one, there's this meetings and groups. Then there's this oral tradition of AA that's not necessarily written down. Some parts of it are, some parts of it aren't, and some parts of it it's modified. Some parts are come from other programs, come from therapy or psychology or wherever it comes from. And then some of it, I don't know where it's from. But there's those two. And then there's the third one. And the third one's always, it seems like it's the last stop on the block for folks. Some people get exposed to it early on and some people don't. And that is the unsummarized version in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And that one is the one with the clear-cut directions. It isn't what to do to recover all by itself. Because it includes, you know, in order to recover, I need the fellowship. I need to not feel like I'm a weirdo, even though I might be. If I'm in a room full of weirdos like me, I feel right at home. And that's funny, you can laugh. I'm not talking about y'all. But anyway, so there's those three parts, and they're a little confusing. Little John, my very first encounter with him is like my eighth day or something like that. And I'm at this meeting, and I think it might have been on gratitude. I really don't remember much about the whole first year. When they say some are sicker as sicker than others in our sister program, and then when they talk about the progression, I was way on down there, and it was even months before I could speak in complete sentences. I mean, my speech was slurred. Not because I was still hammered or I still had dope in my system, but because I, for whatever reason, I brain damage, I think is what they call it. And so it was bad, but, you know, I'd heard some stuff, so I figured it was time for me to speak up at this gratitude meeting. I had some gratitude, you know. I'd been to a meeting sometime that week, and so I start to share about this, about how they closed the meeting somewhere I'd been. They said, let's have a moment of silence for the alcoholic who might walk by here tonight and not even know we're here. And then do the whatever prayer they did. And I said, that's me, folks. Y'all were praying for me. I mean, you were. I didn't tell you this. My sobriety day is May 3rd, 2001, the 50th anniversary of the National Day of Prayer. They were praying for me, you see. And I just thought it was so neat because, see, at that church, this is important, at that very church where we were in this meeting, that church is right down the road from the family plot, the graveyard, where my dad was buried when I was 12 after the plane crash, after I woke up unconscious, covered with blood in the back seat of the airplane and crawled forward and saw him crushed under the wreckage. And where my mom was buried when I was 19 years old from cancer, and where my sister's buried after she was found a year after she was taken from her home in Irving Park in Greensboro. And so I'm telling him this. I think I'm doing pretty good, right? I'm on topic, right? This dude, okay, my first sponsor, right? Sitting over there somewhere, he just cuts me off like I'm not even talking. The guy had no respect. And he just leans over to me, looks at me. He's got this knife in his hand. It's this pirate knife, you know, this curved thing that he's cleaning his fingernails with because he just finished eating his apple with it. And he just looks straight at me and he says, look, dude, I need to tell you something. You can't ever go back to that cemetery again and be the same person. You've got something now you never had before, and that's hope. He said, I know you have hope because you already told us that you came here and you came back, so you must think you have a problem. So you got step one out of the way. He said, you must think that we might be able to help you. You know, we certainly are doing a better job at it than you are. So apparently you've come to believe that there might be something bigger than you, a power greater than you that can help. He's like, now it's time to make a decision. Now you got to make a decision. Are you going to let us? And one of the best ways you can let us is to stop talking and start listening. And I wasn't offended by that. I was just amazed somebody took an interest in me. I mean, the guy, the room was this big, and he's talking to me. I think y'all call that crosstalk. All right, but nobody said anything. I told you he had a knife, and they didn't say anything to him, right? And but I had gone by that church for years since I was 12 years old. For some 23 years, I had gone by that church when I showed up, and I was just amazed. And I found out who this guy was. Everybody knew him. Apparently, he was some big figure in AA. He was controversial and said things like, that I can't say up here, that he did to your girlfriend or your mom. And he would have it printed on shirts and stuff and walk around that way. He just did not care. And I was kind of impressed by a guy that could get away with that sort of thing and had a pirate knife. So I asked him to be my sponsor. I called him up, and he said, sure, no problem. Meet me tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. 8 o'clock in the morning at this meeting over at the Unity Club. And so I got there, and he came in late, and he leaned against the wall with his head back like he was sleeping. And he's one of those guys that would lean forward every once in a while and say, "That's not what the book says," you know, and then he'd go back to sleep. And after the meeting, I went up to him and I said, "Okay, you know, I'm all set. How do we do this thing? You know, I'm ready." And he said, he pointed at two guys sitting on the wall, looking at the floor. He said, "I brought them here. You're taking them home. I'm busy. I got stuff to do. You're going to give them a ride home. You're going to find out what meeting they want to go to tonight. You're going to get their numbers. If they can't get there, you'll go get them and you'll take them there. And call them early in the morning." That's why I was late, because of these two. Call them early in the morning. Wake them up. Make sure they get here on time. And if you have to, go get them. And I'll see you tomorrow. And, yeah, right? So I'm like, well, he didn't hear my question. I'm asking, you know, how do I do this thing? And he gives me this laundry list of stuff to these chores, right? But I don't know if he's still got that knife with him. I don't know what's going on. So I just do what he says. And this guy makes me do this stuff over and over. And he calls me up every once in a while, and he'll give me somebody's name and say, "He's at this such, go get him. Take him to such and such meet, and I'll see you there." And then he wouldn't show up. And he's got me doing this stuff, and then after a while he raises the bar a little bit. He goes over to the little literature table like that over there. One day he picks up that book and he says, "You got $8? And I said, "Well, yes, I've got $8. And he's like, "Okay, give it to me." I'm like, "Why?" He's like, "Because you're buying a book." And, you know, he had gotten sober in prison when meetings had been brought to him where they studied the solution. They studied the solution. And he could tell right away that I wasn't much for reading. I wasn't going to be much of a student at that point. So he just made me do stuff. And what I found out later is he was making me do the stuff right in the book. On page 89, it says that a guy like me that showed up the way I did, that my best insurance, it says, if I don't read it, I'll screw it up. It's page 89. It says, "Practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail." And he had me doing that stuff. Now, I know that appears in the 12th step, but in my book, that is the 13th time it's mentioned. The 13th time it's mentioned in this book. It's mentioned, as a matter of fact, for anybody who's not real sure, at the end of step 4. At the very end of step 4, in whatever that is, it works, I guess, or into action, how it works, something like that. It's at the end of how it works. Talking about where we're writing all that stuff down that we did wrong and that might not be right about us, and we get to that part about sex. Yeah, nobody likes that. Everybody gets quiet at the meeting when you get to page 69. But, you know, you get to that part, and it says this. It says, if sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into working with others. There's the clear direction in step 4 for those who say you can't, you got to wait a year to get there to do it. You know, no, you right then and there. And he had me do stuff, and he kept me sober. He had me doing the action. He didn't bother telling me. And after having tried to tell a bunch of people, you know, if you'll do this, you'll feel better. Nobody listens. So I wouldn't have listened. He didn't ask. He just said, do. And I did. And he was a real likable guy, too. The thing that attracted me to him the most is he just looked from a distance, if you didn't know him, like the meanest, scariest biker dude you ever saw. Had tattoos from his toes to his neck. And he was wide, and he wasn't tall, but he was wide. And but when he would speak, there wasn't an aggressive bone in his body. I mean, the man had lost that. Yeah, I could look at him and hear stories and tell that he had that once before, but that aggression, that anger, was gone. It was gone. There was no hint of it. And, I mean, he would say things to piss people off just to giggle, you know. He was something else. But those three parts of AA is where a lot of confusion comes. And there's a question that people should ask that they don't ask. I think they forget to ask this question. And because somebody introduced me as a big book thumper, I think I'm a crow. Pry your mouth open and shove it down your throater. Personally, that's just my belief. Thumping is nice, but that's a little overly polite for me. You know, I wasn't this way until after I went to some of those treatment centers and those jails and met those people who said it didn't work, who believed it wouldn't work, who were dying from chronic alcoholism, and their only chance was what they call an entire psychic change, page XXVII, from the doctor's opinion. It says these folks that unless they can get the sense of ease and comfort that comes at once from a first drink, they're going to drink again. You know, and their only hope is some sort of entire psychic change. And later they call it a vital spiritual experience. It's on page 27, and that one I cannot remember for some reason. I have to read it. And it says, that's where this guy goes to the doctor, and he says, what do I do? And the doctor basically says, you're screwed. You have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I have never seen one single case recover where that state of mind existed to the extent that it does in you. Guy says to the doctor, is there no exception? The doctor says, oh yes, there is. Exceptions, cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and arrangements, ideas, emotions, and attitudes which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men are suddenly cast aside, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. He's telling him that's your only chance. That's a chronic alcoholic's only chance. According to this program, there may be another one out there with a different idea. I ain't found it yet. By the way, I'm in the market for a 5-day at a time program. If you find it, give me a call. Because this stuff gets exhausting every day, day in, day out, day in, day out. Because I have to do it every day. Where is that one? Oh, I love that one. It's I don't even have to look. It's on page 97. 97, it says, a kindly act once in a while isn't enough. It says, helping others is the foundation stone of your recovery. A kindly act once in a while isn't enough. You have to act the good Samaritan every day. Was it Charmaine? Did she leave? Oh, there you are. How many times a week is every day? All of them. Damn. Okay. Okay. Because I'm constantly looking for the little hole to wiggle through. And I deal with people all the time who say, well, okay, I know the book says one thing, but you don't really have to do that. No, we don't have to do that. But I want to get what these people got. Because I was miserable. You know, 9 years ago today, 9 years ago today, I started a new group the other night on the 8th, on Thursday night. And when I realized the significance of that date, it brought tears to my eyes. Because 9 years ago, this Thursday, past 2 days ago, is that right? 2-3 days ago, I was riding in the back of a paddy wagon down to the North Carolina State Mental Hospital in handcuffs and shackles on my feet with a little chain between them and padlocks with three other guys in the back of the paddy wagon, didn't have no chains on. That was not a fun ride. And, I mean, they didn't do anything, but I was scared the whole time. And I spent the next 4 or 5, I don't know how many days really, in the state mental institution. in the crazy ward. And lawyers couldn't get me out. My family couldn't get me out. Nobody could get me out. I was in this horrible place. And I was in there because right before that, on the 7th, the night of the 7th, or early in the morning, the 8th, the sheriff's department found me in my truck that I had special ordered from Chevrolet and paid ridiculous amounts of money for. And I was passed out with a garden hose in the exhaust pipe and hose in the truck. And because I didn't want to live anymore. I didn't want to live anymore. And when people would, you know, I hear people say all the time, you know, don't drink or you'll die. Well, that I would have been like, where is the die window? I want to sign up. Because I couldn't live anymore. I was 36 years old. My life wasn't what it was supposed to turn out to be. Didn't have what I wanted. Anything I had, I'd lost. I couldn't. I knew I was undependable. I couldn't go anywhere, be anywhere. I couldn't do what I said I was going to do. It just wouldn't happen. And fine, I wanted to get off. I was like, man, if this is the best I can do, it ain't good enough. It ain't good enough for the world. It ain't good enough for me either. My own standards. I'm done. And yeah, that was 9 years ago, Thursday. So I've got to do this stuff. This is my only chance. I'm one of those guys that has to have this this vital spiritual experience. And I said it a minute ago, and I forget what I do, what I'm saying all the time or thinking. And I was going to get a volunteer to help me remember the volunteers' names, but Alan and Charmaine, is that right? Am I getting that right? Charlene. Good. Only in a room full of alcoholics can you count on somebody to correct you. Yeah. I love you folks. You're wonderful. So we were talking about you while you were gone. I told him not to. I said there was a question you should ask. There's a question that should be asked that doesn't get asked. And that question is, well, hold on a minute, Reed Martin. You know, if the book says, and I'm pointing at it and thumping it, saying that if the only way an alcoholic can get sober is this vital spiritual experience, well then how come there's hundreds, if not thousands of people, just in this area alone, that are doing just fine with the don't drink and go to meetings plan? How come? Because there are. They're there. I know they're there. I go to the meetings. I hear them say, oh, you got 90 meetings, 9 days. That's all you got to do. Nothing else. You know, just go to more meetings. Just don't drink. You know, you got a problem. You can't stop drinking. Oh, well, that's easy. Just stop drinking. That's all you got to do. Just stop drinking and go to meetings. And they say other things, and then they say pray, and they have all these other things. They have this kind of oral program that I mentioned earlier of the three AAs. And there's a lot of people that seem like they're doing just fine with that. And they are. I've met them, and they're doing just fine with that. And what is up with that? How come? What's this conflict? You're saying over here this is the only way, and then these people are doing this other way, and they're doing just fine. What's up with that? That's answered in a couple of ways. The easiest way to illustrate it is with the in the To the Wives chapter, where they describe an alcoholic at different levels of progression. I also like the description of the alcoholic. I used to get up here and say, you know, there's drugs in my story. I'm sorry if I'm going to... But then as studying the book, studying the sentences. Let me rephrase that. You don't study the book. You study the sentences. And the description of the alcoholic. I bet y'all have been to a meeting before. I know I've been to... I've heard it 1,000 times. They say, the description of the alcoholic, the chapters of the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage it. Right? Does this sound familiar? Right? The first sentence was the description of the alcoholic. Ooh. And so many people have not read the description of the alcoholic. I've got a little thing here, and it's so small I can't read it. Description of the alcoholic is on 22. Does that sound right? Help me out. Yes, it is. Here's the description of the alcoholic. Now, the sentence down below, it says, this is by no means a comprehensive picture of the true alcoholic, as our behavior patterns vary, but this description should identify him roughly. What description? Well, they say all kinds of things about him, starting on page 21. But then they get to this part where it gets things. It says, as matters grow worse, he begins to use a combination of high-powered sedatives. It does. The book Alcoholics Anonymous says, a true alcoholic uses dope. Drugs. That's what it says. Now, in all fairness, it says, you know, it says it gets worse, you know. And then comes the day where he simply cannot make it and he gets drunk all over again. Perhaps he goes to a doctor who gives him morphine. Yes. That's, if you've never had it, I'm sorry. Then he begins to appear at hospitals, but then that part, it's not a comprehensive picture of the true alcoholic as their behavior patterns vary. I agree with that part, especially. My behavior pattern was different. The high-powered sedatives were better than the liquor. For me. It's just me. I liked the part about, not throwing up and falling down in the throw-up. That was just me. But that's how it describes me. But then, back to this question again. This question, what's the difference? And by the way, somebody left a marker. I stole it. I saw y'all had a marker board. I'd love to do this. This is such a quick and easy way to illustrate. We've only got a few minutes, and I'm going to finish on time, I swear. I've been known to lie. But anyway, see if I can find this thing. Husband number four. We'll start with husband number four. This is in the Two of the Wives chapter. By the way, this is the first chapter I ever read when I got this book home. Right? Because I was going to read it. You see, I found out alcoholism is a disease. It's not my fault. You see? Not my fault. And I was going to take this book home and I was going to beat it over that woman's head and say, see? You need to take care of me. I'm sick. Right? You need to... Right? It's not my fault. Right? And I go through it. I won't go into it, but y'all have heard it before. It's, you know, it just starts going down. And this husband, you know, smashed the treasured crockery and kicked out the door panels and busted things and the paychecks couldn't come home in an armored car. And I'm like, stop reminding her. How is this going to help me? You know, well... Fine, I don't need that book. That's not going to help me. Anyway, the husband number four, what was that? Page 110. They got these four husbands, and I'm going to draw this up here just so you can see. Make a little plus sign right here. And we got husband number one, two, three, four. People love this. Because this answers that question, and I think it's real important to get this point across because I've had a lot of friends who've been in this thing for a while, and then they relapsed. And now they're never going to get back. They're never going to get back. And some of them have died already. Husband number four. Let's hear what they say about that. Okay? And forgive me for... I know a bunch of you little closet big book thumpers are in here. And you do this at home. But you aren't doing it in the meetings. And you leave me to do it. It says, you may have a husband whom you completely despair. He has been placed in one institution after another. He is violent or appears definitely insane when drunk. Sometimes he drinks on the way home from the hospital. I did that on the way home from Butner. I had somebody meet me halfway. I couldn't make it. Sometimes perhaps he has had DTs. Doctors shake their heads and advise you to have him committed. Maybe you have already been obliged to put him away. What do you think they say about this guy? Right? He's screwed, right? No, here's what they say. This picture may not be as dark as it looks. Many of our husbands... Who's our? Where's my volunteers? Who's the our? Many at first... You're slow, Alan. You're slow. Give you one little job to do. Many of our husbands were just as far gone, yet they all got well. Wow. Husband number four, in and out of hospitals, one after another. He gets an approval from AA. Right there is a check mark. Husband number three, what's his story? Here's what they say about husband number three on page 109. They say, this husband has gone much further than husband number two. Though once like number two, we hadn't heard about him yet. He became worse. His friends have slipped away. His home is a near wreck. He cannot hold a position. The doctor's been called in, and the weary round of sanitariums and hospitals has begun. He admits that he cannot drink like other people, but does not see why. He clings to the notion that he will yet find a way to do so. He may have come to the point where he desperately wants to stop, but he can't. His case presents additional questions which we shall try to answer for you. What do you think they say about him? You can be quite hopeful of a situation like this. That seems odd, right? Oh well, husband number three is okay. Man, what? I don't understand where this is going. Let's see what happens. Husband number two, we hadn't heard about him yet. Your husband is showing lack of control, for he is unable to stay on the water wagon even when he wants to. He often gets entirely out of hand when drinking. He admits this is true, but is positive he will do better. He has begun to try, with or without your cooperation, various means of moderating or staying dry. Maybe, he just says maybe, maybe he is beginning to lose his friends. His business may suffer somewhat. He is worried at times and becoming aware he cannot drink like other people. He's remorseful after serious drinking. He's sorry. He knows he did something wrong. And tells you he wants to stop. But when he gets over the spree, he thinks once more how he can drink moderately next time. What do you think they say about this guy? Right? He's got a good chance, right? Yeah? They say, 109, we think this person is in danger. Ooh. Big X. Number two's got an X. That's not good. They think he is in danger. Husband number one, your husband may only be a heavy drinker. His drinking may be constant or it may be heavy on certain occasions. Perhaps he spends too much money for liquor. It may be slowing him up mentally and physically, but he does not see it. Sometimes, not all the time, sometimes he is a source of embarrassment to you and his friends. You would probably be insulted if he were called an alcoholic. This world is full of people like him. Some will moderate or stop altogether. Of those who keep on, a good number will become true alcoholics after a while. It says the world is full of people like him. So we'll put the world up here in number one. And it says, but of the ones who keep going, they will become true alcoholics after a while. And this disease is progressive. But this happens all the time. Here's these guys up here that just don't drink and go to meetings. It says right here in the book, they could moderate or stop altogether. That's what they can do. There are people. More people go to treatment and end up in places all the time. Is that clock right? Okay. People do that all the time. I don't know if I have time to tell you about Richard. Anybody in here named Richard? Richard's not here? You're named Richard? I'm not talking about you. I'm not talking about this guy, okay? But a good example would be this guy, Richard. He's his husband number one. He drinks too much, but not all the time. Only on certain occasions, right? Like the Super Bowl, all right? And so Richard's driving home from the Super Bowl. He goes to the Super Bowl party. He doesn't have any friends, really. He goes because it's a work thing. He doesn't really want to go. They're drinking. He has to drink because it's a work thing. He wouldn't normally drink, or that's what he says. He gets a DUI on the way home. The lawyer and the judge tells him he has to go to AA. He goes to AA. He doesn't find this written down version of AA. He finds the people version. He walks in and he immediately connects. That's a bad sign for Richard, by the way, if he connects. But he connects right away. He's comfortable right away. He meets people and they say, Richard, all you got to do is don't drink and go to meetings. That's all. That's all you got. You get your paper signed, you'll be fine. Richard is a guy who can moderate or stop altogether. So he just stops altogether. He can do that. But he connected. The thing they didn't know here in 1939 that they know now is that alcoholism, chronic alcoholism and addiction, is genetic. Richard's got this thing and he don't know it yet. But his dad had it and his uncle and his grandfather. They all had it. And he's connecting, right? He thinks the same way we do. And he gets in here, and Richard goes to these meetings, and they go around the room, and they say, I'm Alan, and who left, and I'm, what's her name? Charlene. You know, and I'm an alcoholic. And they get around to this guy, and he says, hi, I'm Dick. I'm an alcoholic. And so this Dick is at meetings telling everybody that he's an alcoholic. But see, he's up here, above this line between 1 and 2 and 3 and 4. And I think y'all already figured this out. These people aren't alcoholics yet. These people are. These people only have one chance, and that's a vital spiritual experience. A rearrangement of ideas and emotions. These people aren't there yet. It said these people will end up down here. They said, we think this guy's in danger. They said, we think this guy is going to move on. That's what they found out. That's what they observed. And these guys are up here telling me. And so this guy, Dick, he's going to meetings. He's doing this, and he does this for years. He does it for like 15 years. But it tells us at the bottom of page 14 that if an alcoholic fails to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he will not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. Charmaine, how often is certain? I mean, is that a maybe? No, certain means certain, Charmaine. It means certain. Certain means certain. This is why you have a study where you discuss the sentence. We have to look at this because they slip by us real quick. Certain low spots ahead. One of those certain low spots comes along and this Dick drinks again. And this is bad. And I know this guy. Or I know guys like him, and I bet y'all do too. I see him all the time. He's a guy who comes in and he's hanging out at meetings. He had, you know, 15 years a long time ago, but now he can't get sober. You know, I'm thinking of one guy in particular, and I'm glad he's not here. But, you know, I mean, he goes to the dollar store and he gets some sort of blonde dye because his hair's turning gray, and he tries to dye his hair blonde. It comes out orange, and he does this so he can go hang out at the young people's meeting and pick up start over chips. And he can't get sober. And this guy, they said, we think he is in danger. And he's in danger because 15 years ago, he is absolutely convinced that all he has to do is don't drink and go to meetings. It worked fine. But he ain't up there no more because the disease progressed just like lung cancer. You get lung cancer, you quit smoking, it keeps getting worse. Same thing with alcoholism. And now he's down here, and now he needs a vital spiritual experience, and he's convinced he doesn't need that. And so there we are. There's the two different sets of people. So what do we do? We're doing a disservice. I'm doing a disservice if I go up to Richard and I tell Richard that what you're doing is just fine. Richard, just keep doing what you're doing, because Richard's got a progressive disease that eventually is going to put him in a spot he cannot get out of. And he isn't going to make it. He's going to get to that point where he cannot remember. He cannot bring into his conscious mind with sufficient force the misery of a week or a month ago, which means he's not going to be able to play the tape all the way through. Which is what the treatment center told me. And he's going to drink again. And then he's going to need that thing that he has been talking junk about for years that's written down in that book. I wish I had more time. But it told me there on page 89, that thing that little John tricked me into doing, helping others. You know, it said nothing will so much as ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. Since this is our 12th suggestion, carry this message. This message to other alcoholics. Not that message that I heard across town. Not that message that the guy said. Not that message that my therapist told me. Not that message that my counselor told me. Not that message I read in that really expensive book printed by that ridiculous treatment center that charges $60,000 a year, that charges, you know, $40 for these little books. But this message. It said, carry this message. And it also tells me that when I do this, I get to stay sober. And I wouldn't be able to do it if you guys hadn't invited me to come out here and asked me to do my program today, to work the program of recovery that I learned out of this book. And I'm so proud of y'all for studying it too. And I can't wait to come and study it with you. Thank you. I will. Let me read another hand.